Welcome to the Meat Education Project, the weekly podcast that explores the future of education through the lens of the teachers, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders taking action on it every day. I'm your host, Nick DiNardo. If you would like show notes or more details about our conversations, please visit meateducationproject.com. Now on to this week's show.
Hey everybody, what a great episode we have today with Russ Roberts from the Hoover Institution. I wanted to take a moment to thank one of our sponsors, the Highlander Institute. The Highlander Institute's a nonprofit community of educators and professionals working to improve the educational experience of all learners. For more information about how they can help with their transformative consulting services, their research and development, and their conferences and workshops, and also PD, please visit HighlanderInstitute.org for more information. I couldn't be more happy to be partnered with Highlander and have their support. It's been such an honor to have them support our program. So thanks again, Highlander Institute. And now on to our program with Russ Roberts.
Welcome to the Meat Education Project. I'm your host, Nick DiNardo, and I'm thrilled to have my guest today, Russ Roberts. Russ is a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution and the host of the long-running successful podcast, Econ Talk. He also blogs at Cafe Hayek. Russ, thanks for joining the program today.
My pleasure.
All right. So we always like to start off by talking about the guest journey a little bit, who you are, what you've done, and what inspires what you do in education today. So why don't you take it away?
Well, I've been an economist for a long, long time, and for a while, starting my academic career started around 1980. So for the first 15 years or so, I was a pretty standard academic, trying to write research articles and get published and teaching in the classroom various economics classes to graduate students and undergraduates. And somewhere in the early 90s, I really got the bug to communicate economics to a general audience. And my career since then has reflected that urge. I've written three novels that communicate basic economic principles. I started podcasting in 2006. I co-created the Keynes Hack rap videos, which try to teach people macro. They're on YouTube. And so most of what I do now, and now I'm full-time at Hoover, so my classroom is only the World Wide Web. I don't teach formally in the university classroom anymore. But my classroom is the web, and I'm thrilled and excited and always eager to help people out in the real world understand economics. And some of those are still in classrooms, but I'm not grading them anymore.
That's great. And you've hosted now over 300 episodes. Is that what it is of Econ Talk to date?
It's now over 400, and
wow.
It's an hour long program. So if you go, and they're all up on the web since the first one in the spring, I think, of 2006. So if you wanted to, you could listen to Econ Talk for about 16 straight days, 24/7.
Yeah.
Which is scary, but you could.
Not for us econ dorks. I'm a big fan of the program, and for anybody who's not familiar in the audience, one of the great things about the podcast is that Russ is really good at kind of distilling down a lot of complicated economics topics for non-econ but people interested in economics. So it's a really interesting podcast, and you know, over, I'd say, by my count, 25 or 30 of those episodes are about, you know, education and economics and education. So what is it about the economics of education that interests you?
Well, first, thanks for the kind words about Econ Talk. Education is a common theme. Well, I have four kids, and I think if you care about the country at all or your family, you start thinking about education and the things that we could do better out in the world and the way it's organized or the way it's run. And that's true of the nation. It's true of a city. It's true of a particular school. And it's true for even a classroom. There are always things we can do better. So I'm always fascinated by how things turn out the way they are, why we have certain educational philosophies as parents and as teachers and as policymakers. So it's a fascinating subject, it's a crucial subject, and it's a subject, to be honest, that isn't as scientific as people like to think it is. So the people who are doing research in the area have their pet themes and pet discoveries, and I'm always struck by how difficult it is to measure how various things work in the classroom.
Right, absolutely. And you know, I mean, this podcast series is called the Meet Education Project, and the focus typically is interviews with teachers, entrepreneurs, thought leaders that are really trying to move the future of learning forward. And I really like to get as holistic a view as possible on not just formal education, but informal education and how we can continue to move things. And you've had great guests like Paul Tough, Doug Lamov, Lant Pritchett, Hannah Scheck on a couple of episodes. And one of the consistent themes on there is, you know, the government's impact on education, obviously direct impact on public education, but the importance of school choice for everyone. And that's one of the things that I'm passionate about is, okay, school choice makes a lot of sense, but how do we make sure that it's not just for the affluent? How do we make sure that the disadvantaged also have that opportunity for great quality education? How would you respond to that, or what are your feelings on that?
Well, I don't always think, when you say school choice, of course, that can mean lots of different things. If we think about it in terms of the English language and not just the policy phrase school choice, think about it as just we should all have choices about where we go to school or what we learn or how we learn as individuals or as parents. I think it's even a stronger case, and sometimes I think of it as competition, that it's important that schools compete to attract students and parents to their schools. And it should be for everybody. Rich people have a lot more choices than not rich people on pretty much everything. And it's true in education as well. It's unfortunate to me. So, for example, if you're a wealthy, well-off individual with kids, you can choose where to live, and it's easy for you to buy a house in any school district. So you have a choice right off of where you're going to live, which is a way to choose a school district. And if you don't like the public schools where you live, you can often choose a very good private school. If you're not so well off, in particular if you're poor, you're stuck living in a relatively poor neighborhood, and as a result, you're stuck in a relatively poor school.
Right.
And the public schools know that. They don't literally, the school doesn't say, "Oh, I can take advantage of this." But teachers and administrators in schools that have less competition are always are going to be less concerned about keeping their students happy. And so what I personally would like to see is I'd like to see no government schools. I think government schools have been of a very mixed bag, particularly unsuccessful for low-income people and poor people. But if we're going to keep a public school system, I'd certainly want to find ways to introduce some competition, some choice for people who have fewer choices. And this is such a crucial area. It's so important. And we've abandoned generations of kids in the inner city to horrific school systems, horrific schools, horrific teachers, and I think it's totally unacceptable.
That's a really good segue into my next question, and I like to ask this just to get people kind of thinking about if we were able to ever build an educational system from scratch, which is obviously a huge task, but who doesn't want to be idealistic in some sense. If you could build an educational system from scratch, what would be the core values of that system for you, and what would it look like? Rethinking, you know, let's focus on K-12 here. Let's not even think about higher education.
Well, I mean, the beauty of a real economy, a market economy that isn't controlled from the top down, is that I don't have any idea how any particular industry in that economy should be organized or could be organized. I want to let people who are creative and who have an incentive to try to please the customer to find ways to make their product attractive. We don't do that with schools in general. We do it somewhat with the private school system, K through 12. But of course, if you're trying to create a private school, you're in competition with an incredibly subsidized alternative, an alternative that lets the public school system, which lets its customers enjoy the product for zero out of pocket. They, of course, it's financed by taxes of various kinds, but the current system doesn't give us any idea of what a real private school system would look like. In my fantasy, though, if you ask me, what do I think a great school looks like? A great school is a school that lets its students flourish. And in the private school system, there's a wide array of choices, but I think that in terms of focus on academics, focus on creativity, focus on science, focus on extracurriculars or a more well-rounded approach. There's all kinds of different ways that private schools sell their services to parents, and they charge them a lot of money for them as a result because they're it's expensive to run a great school. I think if we had a totally free school system without free meaning less regulated than the current system, without the free alternative, the no-cost alternative public school system, I'm sure there'd be even more creativity in how people would organize schools to attract students, and I'd love to see that. That would just be that'd be a great thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's you know a lot of the education reform talk is, as you've mentioned on a couple of episodes, it's really difficult to talk about innovation and infusing that innovation into an existing system. But there are some pretty cool private and charter school models that I've seen, you know, as far as, you know, for example, some of the schools in kind of the maker movement where you have, you know, 5-6 year olds kind of focused on making things, using their hands, kind of being entrepreneurial in that sense. And some schools design based on the framework of design thinking or building entrepreneurial skills, obviously for the 21st century workforce. Those are some pretty cool models that I like to see. But again, you have to build it from scratch, like you said.
And I would mention, you know, when I say I want a private school system or a system without subsidized public schools like we have now, obviously people who have low income would have trouble getting into, possibly paying for, the best schools, which might be quite expensive if everybody had to pay their way. And I've suggested one of the problems with the current public school system is how people treat things that are given to them. In the current public school system, parents are given the education for the children, and I think they treat it accordingly. They don't give it necessarily the care and passion that they would if they had to pay with their own money. But having said that, it raises the question, what if you're poor? How are you going to go to a school that's $12,000, $15,000, $20,000 a year? How are you going to be able to pay for that? In the current world, the way poor people go to schools is they go to a public school that's financed out of tax dollars, rather than their own tuition. And that doesn't work very well. It's important to mention that when people complain about how a private school system might work, they say, well, the poor kids would get bad schools. Well, they get bad schools now. They're really bad schools. Now, there could be a lot of reasons for that. It could be cultural. It could be regulatory. It could be a lot of reasons. But the current system does not work very well. My view is that if we had a private school system without government running it the way it does now, we would have an opportunity for people to donate money to poor people to subsidize through their tuition, which, of course, is even happening now. Even in today's world, people who are financially well off make donations to private schools to make sure that there's more diversity in those schools. And sometimes they're not donating to the schools. They're donating to a scholarship fund to let kids who are poor get out of their awful public school system, public schools, so that they can have a decent education. So I'm confident there'd be a lot of charity to help poor kids go to expensive schools. Whether it'd be, quote, enough, or whether we'd be happy with that, the way it would turn out, I don't know. But I'd say now is a great time for experimentation, given how awful the current system is. And, of course, there are many entrenched interests that fight desperately to keep that experimentation from happening. And I'd like to see us win a few of those battles.
Sure. Well, let's focus a little bit on developing countries. One of the most recent episode that I listened to was the Lant Pritchett episode. And he mentions one thing I found really interesting about how Finland should not be used as a model for poor countries.
Right.
Probably because of demographic and population size differences and things along those lines. However, we need to do something to provide equity and cultivate curiosity among young learners there. So do you think there's a way to derive a model for those countries, or maybe Lant mentioned something along those lines?
Well, it's interesting. When I did that interview with him, which was, I don't know, maybe 2 months ago, his basic theme was, as you said, that it wasn't just actually talking about as a model for poor countries, but even for rich countries. A lot of people have said, well, look how well Finland's doing on say, the PISA test, which is an international exam on reading and math and comprehension. And Finland does really well, and they're very centralized. So maybe a centralized system is the answer. We just need to do our system better. And I think what Lant Pritchett was saying is that you can't generalize from one success or one failure. because there may be things specific to Finland you don't know about, and that your particular situation as a nation might not map into those. And that comes back to my earlier point, which is when you centralize school systems, which is what we have a lot of in the United States, there is a tendency to think, okay, what's the solution? We need more X or less Y, when in fact we need to just let trial and error take place and let good schools thrive and bad schools fall by the wayside. Instead, good schools are rare and bad schools persist in our current system. And to me, the biggest thing wrong with our current system and the biggest thing wrong with how we talk about reforming it is because we're always thinking about, oh, yeah, we need smaller classrooms. Like, oh, that's what we need because that's what, say, Finland has. But that's not the way things typically work. So his first point, I think, is correct. That it's true that just because, say, Finland has small classes and they're successful doesn't mean it'll work for us. But the general, more general point is, why would you think there's one magic policy or four or eight magic policies that could be imposed from the top down? I tend to think that the bigger problem is more systemic. It's more about the incentives that the players within any school face. So that's the first point about Finland, which is that I don't want to take whatever's good about Finland and use it here because that'll fix our system. I wouldn't want to let our system evolve and emerge and it's let it be more organic rather than controlled. So that's the from the top down. And so that's the first point. The second point is that right after I finished that interview with Lance Pritchett, the new PISA scores came out and Finland fell precipitously, didn't do particularly well, was passed by a lot of the Asian countries. And I don't know, if you look at the Asian style of learning in some situations, it may be appropriate, I think, in math very well. But in general, I don't necessarily want to get a high PISA score as the goal of my educational system. And so I just think that whole debate is somewhat sterile.
Yeah.
Again, the idea that I can just fix this through the right policy is crazy.
No, that's true. And then, you know, the other argument is that, okay, how much can you actually take from these PISA scores? I mean, you know, China is pretty selective on, okay, which states are actually the ones that we're gonna have actually submit to PISA, all that sort of stuff. So then you get into all those idiosyncrasies. But absolutely. So what do you think is the one thing that gets you most excited about the future of education and learning?
Well, I do think that the digital revolution has tremendous potential. It's obviously going to have a lot of bumps and detours along the way, but the innovations of Khan Academy and Udacity, Coursera, the stuff that's coming out of Stanford and MIT that's available to anybody in the world is extremely encouraging to me, and I'm very excited about it. There's uncertainty about how effective it can be. There's uncertainty about what courses and what it'll be best applied to, how much it can substitute for online learning, can substitute for brick-and-mortar schools with traditional teachers standing in front of the classroom. But what's great is that we are living in a time of great innovation, despite all the barriers I alluded to earlier that make it hard to innovate, that entrench special interests that make it hard to innovate in the educational field. It's happening anyway. Innovation's coming. It's already here. There's already, I think, a lot of improvement. And, one of the things you alluded to earlier is not all learning takes place in the classroom, and a lot of people are supplementing their classroom learning at K-12 with these resources that are online. And, of course, a lot of adults are doing things like listening to this podcast or mine and educating themselves about what's going on in the world without going to a formal classroom experience. So I think the availability of digital resources is really just extraordinary, and I think it has tremendous potential.
That's great. Now, just out of curiosity for my own interest, what was your favorite interview or most fascinating interview to you about current issues in education?
You mean that I've done?
Yeah, that you've done.
Pretty fun talk?
Right.
Doug LeMov, which was recent, was extremely inspiring. His book, Teach Like a Champion, is very good. But I found his passion for excellence to be very inspiring. Now, most of that passion is about how to make a particular school great, a particular classroom great. And if you are in a dysfunctional system, you can be very frustrated by attempts to, just for example, let's talk about high expectations. If I'm a teacher, and my wife's a math teacher also, by the way. who's also a teacher. We both believe that high expectations of your students are a great way to encourage learning. These are very important, not to dumb the material down, not to allow failure and shrug it off. Failure is an opportunity to learn more, to be motivated. And there's a lot of just casual empiricism, just stories you read about in the paper of teachers who quit because they were expected to give high marks and not fail anybody. And, you know, what Doug Lamont was talking about, one of the things he was talking about is how incredibly important it is to look for constant ways to improve your teaching and to give feedback to students. And he has a whole bunch of things that are relevant for making a teacher better. But if you're in a dysfunctional school system, and Doug works in a charter school system that has some freedom, but if you're in a dysfunctional school system, well, your ability to implement those improvements or your ability to benefit from those improvements or to be have the freedom to implement some of the techniques he talks about is going to be very limited. So with that caveat, I found it very inspiring that there are ways to improve classroom teaching that have real potential. So I really enjoyed that one. I think the Lance Pritchard one, which you mentioned, where he talks about some of the tragic failures of education in the third world, particularly in extremely poor countries, the amount of resources that have been thrown at education, the amount of effort and time that's put in with no results, mainly because nothing really happens. Teachers collect their salaries without actually teaching. Sometimes they collect their salaries without showing up. And it reminds me, and this is always worth remembering, that published data, one of the most important things I learned from his interview is that you have to always remember that published data are not always true.
You're right.
It's hard to understand that. He's talking, I think he's talking about how years of schooling in extreme, I think it was in Haiti, is today roughly equal to what years of schooling was in France in 1960, but the average Haitian is not getting the education that some is not learning. Years of schooling isn't learning.
Right.
And that's an incredibly difficult thing to remember, especially if you're an empirical economist, you're doing statistical analyses, measuring years of education against various factors and trying to find relationships. And if the data are meaningless, your results are going to be meaningless. And I think that was a really valuable lesson to be reminded of. I think everybody knows that somehow, somewhere, but it's easy to forget it.
Yeah. I think it was Eric Hanischep mentioned the same exact thing, where it seems to be pretty easy to quantify that, where it's, okay, let's take total years of schooling, and that will be, you know, then we can measure growth rate from there, when it's really there's a gray area. You know, it's not just that black and white, especially now. Absolutely.
And in America, we have the same issue with college. And we've been talking about K-12, but with universities and college education, we talk about how the average college student earns more than the average student who doesn't go to college. That's true. But what we don't know is how much of that's due to the fact that you go to college versus the people who go to college aren't the same as the people who don't go. And certainly, when you try to measure that, one of the problems you have is that a person who studies one set of subjects in college is very different from somebody who studies another set in terms of their preparation for the job market. Now, that's another thing we care about. We care about life, and I took lots of classes in college that didn't help me make money. I'm really glad I took them. They made me better rounded, and I hope a better parent. There are a lot of good things about education that aren't financial or monetary, but if we're looking at that effect, you can't just ignore the fact that 4 years of college at one university studying one thing is not the same as 4 years at a different school studying something else. But when we analyze them typically in statistical studies, they're just lumped together as years of education, as if that's somehow the same amount of growth and learning took place, and that's wrong.
Absolutely. Let's touch on that a little bit. Higher education. There's a lot of talk right now, obviously, about the higher education bubble and the Thiel Fellowship, where Peter Thiel is actually, you know, paying students to forego their college studies to actually get experiential learning and become entrepreneurs. What is your take on this whole thing? And I mean, where do you think education will be in the next I mean, higher education will be in the next 10 years?
Well, you know, students get a lot out of higher education besides what they learn in the classroom, and that's part of what people pay for when they go to college. And that's true of high school, by the way, and K through 12 also, right? We don't just care about the acquisition of skills. There's social skills, there's growing up, there's identity, there's extracurricular, sports, music, art. There are all these things we care about besides reading and writing. But we care about reading and writing. It's really important. But we also care about these other things. So in terms of college, you know, I think there are a lot of people who go to college and all they get out of it is the piece of paper that says they survived and were able to stay focused for 4 years. Not bad. It's worth something. The market tends to view that favorably, the job market. But there are, it's a smaller group of people, smaller group of students who go to college to master something, whether it's engineering or to be pre-med or to study economics, say. That's a much different experience. And it's an expensive experience, right? And the question is whether it could be gained through a different set of courses online, shorter time in school. A four-year university is an extremely expensive way in terms of time and money to acquire knowledge. Now, experiential learning is a great idea. Most of life is learned from experience. Most of what we know, we learn from experience. Most of us aren't just in fields that require technical expertise and the acquisition of knowledge. A lot of what we learn can't be imparted by a mentor or a teacher. It can only be experienced and learned. And I think there's no doubt about that. That's true. So I think what I would expect to happen, whether it will happen or not, is hard to know. But I'd expect the fact that college is so expensive. Forget the fact that they, people finance it with large loans that they're going to, that some people struggle to pay back. But just the fact that it takes 4 years, there are likely to be some alternatives to that, through the net, through digital learning. On the other hand, the fact that it's persisted for so long suggests to me that a lot of what people value out of college is not just the learning. It's the opportunity to be away from home in a relatively safe and cloistered environment where you can explore your identity and other aspects of life. Some of that's cheering for a football team and other not so educational things. And so that's also part of that experience, and that's going to require brick and mortar and regular traditional education, as we call it in the United States, and it's not going to be replaced by some sort of experiential program or some sort of online learning. So, you know, I expect there to be some innovation. I think it's coming. Remains to be seen how important or widespread it will be.
Yeah, I think it's painting too broad of a brush to say, okay, this is a bubble that's just going to completely pop. I mean, if you deconstruct it, there's obviously specific needs. Sal McCann, I've heard talk about, okay, if you break down what higher education is, it's a combination of learning, socialization, and the credential, and you talked about that. I think you're going to see some colleges go out of business. Some colleges are definitely not differentiating themselves well enough and obviously not delivering results. They'll go out of business. But the big brand names, the big four-year public schools are obviously going to remain the same. But I'm seeing some really cool models come about as far as competency-based learning things, kind of looking at what a course is or what a credential is and deconstructing it on what a student can actually do. And then the testing is not just a, hey, let's take a multiple choice or open response test. Show me exactly how you're going to be able to get that done. And that can be done, obviously, in only certain types of disciplines as well. It's going to be more quantitative and hands-on type stuff. But it's interesting.
Yep.
So
good stuff coming, I think.
Yeah, I agree. So just getting to my last question. If you could have dinner with one person you admire, past or present, who would it be and why?
Well, that's a good question. I assume that person's not doing the cooking, so I assume that the appeal of the evening is the conversation.
That's right.
And I have to say, I'm very lucky, as are you. You know, when you host a podcast, you get to talk to a lot of interesting people. So I'm going to give you a kind of a little bit of an offbeat answer. I've been lucky enough to talk. You know, I've had over 400 episodes. We mentioned earlier there's a a handful of people who've been on many times, but I probably had, I don't know, 300 something guests. And a lot of them have been extraordinarily interesting people. Just to mention one of my favorites, Christopher Hitchens, who I interviewed about Orwell. He was an incredible conversationalist. I spent a lot more time with him that afternoon than just the hour that ended up being recorded for Econ Talk. And he passed away shortly after that.
Right.
And I'm glad I had a chance to talk to him. There are a lot of people who aren't alive I'd love to interview for Econ Talk. But the one I wish I could talk to now, who I did talk to, but only a while ago, is Milton Friedman. I interviewed Milton Friedman in 2006, right before the recession that started in December 2007, followed by the financial crisis of 2008. And we live in these extraordinary times for macroeconomics. And I sure wish I could have dinner with Milton and find out what he thinks of what's happened in the last 5 years.
Wow.
So that'd be my answer. But it'd be a long list, I guess, of other folks outside of economics. But in terms of economics, it'd be Milton. I wouldn't mind meeting Adam Smith, I guess, either. That would be fun. I'm writing a book on Adam Smith's theory of moral sentiments.
Oh, great.
And so chatting with him about that would be nice, but it's kind of a long shot.
Yeah, it's a long shot, you're right, but you can dream. What about where our audience can find you on social media, your blog, all that stuff?
So my podcast is at econtalk.org. Econ Talk is on Facebook as well. My Twitter handle is econtalker, econtalker, and I blog at Cafe Hayek. I've got way too many things going on the web, but anybody who wants to find me can find me there.
You're easy to find. Thanks again, Russ, for the time. Really appreciate your work and everything you do. So thanks again.
Thanks, Nick. It was fun talking.
Bye, Russ.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you would like show notes or more details about our conversations, please do visit meeteducationproject.com. Please also subscribe to us on iTunes under Meet Education Project. Thanks, and see you all next time.